Hello, and welcome back to the Cuse Conversations podcast. I'm John Boccacino, Senior Internal Communications Specialist at Syracuse University.
The database, I think, is going to be such a powerful research, but also teaching tool. And in fact, I used examples from the database in an upper-level history seminar that I'm teaching right now. I used them just yesterday, where I distributed examples to different students, and I had them analyze these as primary documents and said, you know, what do you get from looking at this sheet that you didn't know before about the realities of slavery? There are multi-generational family trees that you can derive from these. They're quite bureaucratic documents. And when you look at them, they might seem to be just kind of listing bald facts. But when you really engage with what they're telling you, they're testifying to the violence that underlay this system and that really informed the daily lives of the people whose names are being recorded here.
This was a really unique opportunity to sort of practice what we really talk about in the iSchool, which is being interdisciplinary, being transdisciplinary, where we cross over and we help and we work with other disciplines that need to have their data and their information more accessible and easier to interpret and understand. What's really fascinating about this particular project is the amount of data, number one, the traditional inaccessibility of the data from a search perspective, and the effort that we put into making it much more accessible and searchable. And I think that is transformative. It's going to be transformative for a lot of people.
Today on the podcast, I am thrilled to welcome on, it's a fascinating study, blending the past, our history, with the future, with some great data research. It's an interdisciplinary topic here on the Cuse Conversations podcast of really how to keep track of people who used to be slaves and their descendants who want to know more about their history. And it's, of course, involving two esteemed faculty members here at Syracuse University. Tessa Murphy is an associate history professor in the Maxwell School. Michael Fudge is a professor of practice in the School of Information Studies. And they are both kind enough to join us here on this fascinating episode of the Cuse Conversations podcast. I want to thank you both for stopping by today. Tessa, I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit more about your background and this line of research that you've been focused on here with Maxwell and keeping track of enslaved former residents, if you will, of the British colonial territories.
Great. Thank you so much for inviting us to be on today. As you mentioned, I'm an associate professor of history here, and this is my second book-length project. I came to it after finishing my first book, which was published in 2021, and focused on the interconnected histories of the small islands in the Southern Caribbean, places like St. Lucia, St. Vincent, Dominica, and Grenada. And as I was finishing that book, I felt compelled to learn more about the enslaved people who constituted the majority of the population of those islands throughout the colonial period, but whose histories remain very little known to us because they were denied access to literacy, they were unable to therefore leave first-person accounts, and also because they were largely treated as property rather than as people. And so one way that we can learn about their lives and experiences are through these registries that the British imperial government created beginning in 1814 in Trinidad and continuing all the way to the emancipation of enslaved people in the British Empire in 1833. So together with Michael, we're starting by focusing on the registries of people who were enslaved in the colony of St. Lucia in 1815. So there are two registries, one registering people who were enslaved on plantations, the other people who were enslaved in households. And in total, we're talking about more than 16,000 individuals. And the registries provide information about their first names, last names, heights, colors, primary occupations, their region of origin, whether in Africa or another colony, any distinguishing physical characteristics, as well as any family ties to other people who were enslaved in the same plantation or household. So as you can imagine, that's a real wealth of information. And so Michael has been instrumental in helping me organize what for me as a person who's used to dealing with kind of fragments of archives is a really big amount of information here.
It's really a fascinating interdisciplinary merger between these two colleges, these two schools and colleges, and these two skill sets in both the research and then the interpreting that research and making it searchable for, again, descendants of these former slaves or people that want to find out more about these residents of St. Lucia in 1815, which, again, there's more than 16,000 people that we're tracking. I want to turn, we're going to start off at a very surface level with our conversation here. And Michael, I want to bring you on to talk a little bit more about, you know, your role. And when someone hears you're a professor of practice in the School of Information Studies and you focus on digital transformation and the impact of information technology on society, how does, what exactly is your, in layman's terms, your line of work? And how would a project like TESIS, how did this come to be this partnership?
I chuckle, John. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. Yeah, I do focus on, I think the iSchool in general focuses on how we can use information to better society, whether that is through transforming the way that we work and live. To one of my interests is in better ways and smarter ways we can educate people with the data and information that we are collecting and gathering. And nowadays, you know, we see that data and information are everywhere. So what really attracted me to this project, being a professor of practice, I spent many years in industry with data, doing data warehousing. As I always say, I look at data and see rows of data that represent, you know, products or orders or events that happen. And this was a really unique opportunity to sort of practice what we really talk about in the iSchool, which is being interdisciplinary, being transdisciplinary, where we cross over and we help and we work with you know, other disciplines that need to have their data and their information more accessible and easier to interpret and understand. What's really fascinating about this particular project is the amount of data, number one, the traditional inaccessibility of the data from a search perspective, and the effort that we put into making it much more accessible and searchable. And I think that is transformative. It's going to be transformative for a lot of people.
Tessa, how did you get connected with Michael? How did the two of you, with your areas of research, you know, really start to form this partnership?
Yeah, it's a great question because it was very serendipitous, and I'm just so grateful that it happened. I know one person who works in the iSchool. I can't say I'm particularly connected to the iSchool. And so as I started to realize that the amount of information I was dealing with was really beyond my capacity as like a non-data-driven historian, I reached out to her and I said, I don't think this is your area, but do you know anyone who might be able to help me here? And so she put me in touch with Michael. I think I just shot him an email. This would have been a couple of years ago now. And luckily for me, he was very interested in it. And since then, we've been able to hire people through respective grants through The Source, which is Syracuse's Office of Undergraduate Research and Creative Engagement, I believe is the full name there. And so we've both been really fortunate to hire students from our respective disciplines who can also contribute to this project. So it's collaborative between the two of us, but also now including a lot of undergraduate and then also a couple of graduate students who have helped us build and analyze this database across a couple of years now.
And Michael, from your perspective, you get this, I know you mentioned a little bit earlier that this really typifies what you want to do and what you do with the iSchool and taking data and kind of humanizing it and making it have a relevant, you know, purpose. What was your first reaction when you heard from Tessa?
Well, you know, as Tessa explained, it was like a cold call. And I get a lot of cold calls, I got to be honest with you. You know, when rumor gets out that you have a certain area of expertise, you tend to get reached out a lot. But what really attracted me to this was the potential impact that we have. I just had a vision of a family member somewhere trying to track down a long lost relative and how difficult that would have to be if you're looking through digital pages of information, and how us as part of this digital humanities project, making this information more accessible. And it actually brought up also a very unique challenge, as I'm sure we'll talk about as we get further in the podcast, but the actual nitty-gritty of transcribing the data is non-trivial. And if it were trivial, I wouldn't, you know, Tessa wouldn't need me, and there would be other ways to do it, but it's a very distinct and a challenge that we had to come up with some creative ways to make it happen. So that's what really got me into it, was it not only was it, you know, purposeful and, you know, had it's it epitomizes doing good, but also it was just a very fascinating problem that just didn't have an easy solution.
To give our audience some background, Tessa, we mentioned her expertise with Maxwell. She has one book out currently, The Creole Archipelago, Race and Borders in the Colonial Caribbean, which was published in 2021, which really served as the great example of your research and how you're trying to trace these generations of indigenous, free and enslaved Africans and settlers. So we start off, it's 1815, the island of St. Lucia, and you come up with this database or this list of 16,000 or so former slaves who resided on that British colony. How did you go about getting your hands and sifting through these registries to come up with the data set that turned into this database?
Yeah, well, luckily, because I started this project during the pandemic hit, and I realized I'm not going to be getting to an archive anytime soon. And very fortunately, the ledgers themselves, like the registries, are these large bound books that are held in the British National Archives, which are just outside of London. But there was no way I was getting to London anytime soon. And luckily, photographs of those documents are digitized on ancestry.com and are available through SU's library subscription, but they're handwritten and the quality of the photos is not great. And to add another kind of wrench in the works, although St. Lucia at this time was a British colony, 90% of this particular registry is in French because it had been a French colony until it was conquered by Great Britain during the Napoleonic Wars. And so the people who are registering their enslaved people are French speaking. And so this is the one registry in the entire British Empire. There are 671 in total. These two registries are the only ones that are in French just by some fluke. And so it's been interesting research because especially when we were in the transcription stage, it was imperative to hire student transcribers who could read 19th century French handwriting. And as you can imagine, those students are a bit few and far between. So it was great to kind of seek them out, often through the Department of Romance Languages and Literatures. And to work with them with this kind of unfamiliar at times vocabulary, antiquated and often offensive terms, and certainly just figuring out what letter is that? Because the handwriting has changed a lot over the last couple of hundred years.
And how detailed were these records that you're coming across on ancestry.com?
The registries for St. Lucia and for other crown colonies, so that would be Trinidad and then Berbice, which becomes part of Guyana, they're incredibly detailed. And this is because crown colonies didn't have elected assemblies. And so it was actually officials in England who were able to say, okay, this is the information that we want. In other British Caribbean colonies like Jamaica or Barbados, there are really powerful local elected assemblies that when British Parliament says, okay, you need to register every enslaved person in the colony, the planters who are members of those elected assemblies say, fine, we'll register them. We'll do their first name, their color, maybe their height and whether they're African or American born. And that's it. So that's still something, but it doesn't give us anywhere near this level of detail. And so with the registries for St. Lucia and Trinidad, and Berbice, these crown colonies, we've got, I believe, 9 columns in the original registry: first name, last name, height, color, occupation, age, distinguishing physical characteristics, family ties, and then corrections. So any updates that are made in future iterations of the registry. And then, as Michael will be able to tell you, we engineered other columns to give us more information about those individuals and families.
And I want to keep with you, Tessa, for a little bit before we go to Michael, because you obviously are the one who this is your expertise when it comes to dissecting and studying this. And you're, I know you're a researcher who is proficient in this field, but I'm sure, what did you learn about maybe life in St. Lucia in 1815 from the database that maybe you weren't quite privy to based on your previous research?
Yeah, the database, I think, is going to be such a powerful research, but also teaching tool. And in fact, I used examples from the database in an upper level history seminar that I'm teaching right now. I used them just yesterday, where I distributed examples to different students, and I had them analyze these as primary documents and said, you know, what do you get from looking at this sheet that you didn't know before about the realities of slavery? And it's fascinating to see what students come up with. So they were all struck by how short people were and what that suggested about malnutrition. That for the distinguishing physical characteristics, they asked questions about why might people be branded as some of them were, and what does that suggest about their experiences of the Middle Passage being trafficked from West Africa to the colonies. There are multi-generational family trees that you can derive from these. I was really struck by the fact that despite the reality that people lived very short lives, we can also see, because of the ages of these families, that girls really started bearing children in their teen years. And so we do see four generational families, even though it was very unusual for a person to live beyond the age of 60. And so they're quite bureaucratic documents. And when you look at them, they might seem to be just kind of listing bald facts. But when you really engage with what they're telling you, they're testifying to the violence that underlay this system and that really informed the daily lives of the people whose names are being recorded here.
And were there any family anecdotes? Were there any situations of reconstructing the lives of these people who, again, were enslaved in the British colonies that really stood out to you, that, again, paints more of a picture of, you know, what life was like, how hard things must have been, and how they functioned on a day-to-day basis?
Absolutely. I think that there are going to be countless life stories that and family stories that come out of these registries. But right now, we're at work on a couple of pieces. I'm doing a research, like a traditional history article, and then Michael and I are working together on a research article about the database itself. And for the history article that I'm writing, I'm really centering it around the matriarch of this four-generational family living on a coffee plantation in northeastern St. Lucia. And you can tell from the registry, she was born in a neighboring colony called Martinique. So she ends up at some point trafficked to this neighboring French colony. We know what happened within the first 29 years of her life because her daughter is born in St. Lucia when she is 29 years old. We know the age at which her daughter began to bear children of her own and her daughter's daughter. So we can see regional trafficking that's not captured by existing databases. We can see the importance of reproductive labor in the perpetuation of slavery in plantation colonies. We can see, you know, it notes that she's marked with pox. So we can see members of the family who would have survived infectious disease. It's really possible to spin out quite rich life histories and genealogies just from these very simple lines on the ledger.
That's why I think it's so commendable what you both are doing to bring this project to life. And we'll get in a little bit to the takeaways and how we're going to use this database for good. But I want to segue to Michael, your role here in taking this data. So Tessa comes up and she works and has student workers, and they're kind of collaborating. They're giving you they're trying to get their hands on this data itself that goes into this database. Pick up the story from there. What are you doing? How did you incorporate this data when she and her team come to you? And how did we get going with this searchable database? What was your role and how did this all play out?
First and foremost, the original scans, well, they weren't originals, but the ones on Ancestry.com, most people's approach to this might be to try to OCR that, where you run software that tries to read the characters itself so that a person doesn't have to read the characters. There's actually two, in my eye, there's two reasons why that, well, there's one reason why it wasn't going to work. And then two, the second reason is why it shouldn't be done in the first place. And the first reason is it's probably not going to work, and it didn't work when we tried it. I didn't think it was going to, and then it didn't when we tried it because of the nature of the script that was written in the early 18th century or in the early 1800s, I should say, just is not something that the OCR, the optical character recognition software, can find very easily. And so you would get a lot of information out where some of it was accurate, but a lot of it was garbled. And while you can maybe run that through some correction software, now you're in a situation where you could be, and this is part number two, sure, rewriting history. And what we don't want to do here is rewrite history. We want to be very careful that the information that we can acquire from each page is transcribed as accurately as possible into a registry of sorts, into the database registry of sorts. And that is really my number two. And that was something that I sort of picked on that before number one, honestly, was that, you know, you're talking about people and lives, and you know, there's going to be others that are going to be searching for names and using this data in a variety of ways. And you want to make sure it's as accurate as possible as it's coming off the page. So when I got involved, the first thing that we did was we had to figure out a way to allow the students, as they went through and transcribed the data, to put it in some kind of common format so that my student and I could then write a program that reads all of these individual transcriptions from each page and then compiles them into a larger data set. And so what we decided to do, for good or bad, was we decided to use a Google Sheet where we had it laid out exactly the way that the registry was laid out, so that the student who was doing the transcriptions from French to English and then also adding the lines of individuals to the sheet could number each individual as they were numbered and then put in all of their information, name, height, color, marks, country, employment, et cetera. And if there was we encouraged them to actually write it as it was written. And if you think back to like 1815, you know what they weren't thinking about back then? Searchable databases, right? Someone's job was to write something down and be done with it, right? And being a data analytics person, one of the things that makes data useful is that it's consistent, right? And clean, and that we don't have a situation where it says someone came from the African Congo, and then it says someone came from the African Congo, but it's got a lowercase a instead of a capital A. And all those little things like that make your data less easy to search and makes it harder for that data to become information, right? So what we did as part of the compiling of these sheets together, as they're written as is run just a little bit of mindful intelligence over them to fix things like that. And with Tessa's experience, we would do some like basic lookups, and like you might have a job that someone had as a laborer, and the phrase laborer could be spelled many different ways in the registry, but it all means the same thing. So we kept the original transcription in there and then generated a column that says all these mean laborer. And so that way, when you're going to try to do analytics, like count the number of laborers in St. Lucia, you can get a very clean and consistent output.
How seamless of a process was it for you? And you mentioned making it searchable. That's a buzzword that people have to throw around, but like, how hard was it to, in reality, go through? Some people might only have four or five data set entry points, and others have all the criteria put down by the slaveholders. So how did you kind of merge the discrepancies to come up with what we have today?
Yeah, there was a lot of review that was done between my student, who was a grad student, Ian, over at the iSchool at the time, and Tessa's students who were doing the transcriptions. There was a lot of collaboration that went on where they would review inconsistencies, and then any inconsistencies that they couldn't figure out, they would bubble them up to Tessa to review. And that's the way we try to maintain most of the data integrity as we were going sheet to sheet. Now, the program that combines them all together was relatively trivial, I should say. Not, I don't want to say it's totally trivial because you're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Google Sheets on a Google Drive. But once we had the structure pretty well laid out in the Google Sheets, it was fairly simple programmatically to combine them all together. Now, when you combine them together, you might not get very consistent data. So that's where a lot of the things like the lookups and that kind of logic really sort of helps out. And we were very careful in the completed database to indicate which columns came from the original page and which columns we manufactured from the original page. I'll give you another great example. You know, Tessa mentioned height. And height is transcribed in the registry as like 4'3". So 4, you know, apostrophe 3 quotation mark. You can't do any kind of quantitative comparison on that because it's a textual value. So rather than having a person that we, you know, hire to change 4'3" into 45", we wrote software to do that, to read those. And what happens is if it can't figure it out, it lets you know, and then someone has to review it. And a human has to go in there and fix it. And those kinds of things really enrich the data set, because the more dimensions of data that you have to sort of explore these individuals by, I think the greater stories you can tell.
Yeah, it's really remarkable just hearing these anecdotes of, again, this interdisciplinary research that's being merged between Maxwell and the iSchool. And Tessa, I know that this is your passion project, this is your area of expertise, and you mentioned the goals of this when you set out. Now that we've kind of gone through and as we're sitting here discussing the database, which I believe you mentioned earlier had almost 400 plantations that were covered, nearly 16,000 people, what are your thoughts on the monumental task that you both have undertaken and how it turned out?
Well, I will say it's a big task, but it's also just the beginning. We chose to begin with St. Lucia because I have worked on St. Lucia in the past. And so I felt like I was approaching it with a clear sense, and I've been to St. Lucia. So I had a clear sense of kind of where these plantations might have been. And that's important to me, kind of thinking about how people might have experienced this place. So we started with St. Lucia, but we do have the goal of including other equally detailed registries. I think there were almost 700,000 individuals who were registered in the British Caribbean, and we do not have the goal, to my mind at least, Michael might feel differently, of compiling a database that will include all of them, in part because those registries are just nowhere near as detailed, and so what we can hope to get from them is much greater for St. Lucia. We've started now to work on Trinidad, which similarly was a crown colony that the British acquired during the Napoleonic Wars. And as a result of being a crown colony, the registries that were created there are equally detailed, but there's also far, far more people who were enslaved in Trinidad. And so that will be a bigger task. It will be a task that's all in English. So our ability to hire people who they don't also have to be able to read 19th century French. So we should have a bigger pool of applicants, I would hope. And what's great is now we have this kind of template of what this information looks like and how it might be entered. And so hopefully that will facilitate getting this done. But the plan is we've done St. Lucia. We hope to do Trinidad. We may also do British Honduras, which is now Belize, because they also have the family groupings there. We may do Berbice. Those are conversations that we'll have down the line. But my goal is certainly to produce a second book project that really centers the experiences of people who were enslaved at the newly acquired frontiers of the British Empire, in what's usually celebrated as this age of abolition, this time when slavery was coming to an end, when for people who were living in St. Lucia and Trinidad, in fact, slavery was perhaps accelerating as the British Empire arrived in these territories that had previously been sort of peripheral colonies of France and Spain, respectively.
this is going to be something that could be beneficial to the government of St. Lucia. It can be beneficial to anyone who had descendants who perhaps they heard a story of them being, you know, a slave in one of these countries. Just how does that impact your work, knowing that there's a lot of tangible good that will come out of this project?
Yeah, I'll answer that one first. So from my perspective as an information professional, one of the things I love about this data set, besides the things I've already mentioned, is that it's easy for a fellow student to just pick it up and understand the bits and pieces that are in here. A lot of times when I use other data sets in class, there's a whole backstory I have to explain about a business process or anything like that. It's very easy to understand what you're seeing in this data set. And there's a lot of teachable things from a technology standpoint, as well as from a historical standpoint. So it lets me get out of my comfort zone a little bit. And I really enjoy that and appreciate that. There's a couple really interesting hard problems that have to be solved in a data set like this. Like when you're processing and compiling it, how do you know that you didn't already add somebody in there who's in there already, right? So there's little things like that that are non-trivial that I get to speak to with my students when I use this data set in one of my classes, and I have. And I'm going to think about using this in a couple of my other classes. One of my classes is an intro to programming. And we use some data sets in there to do some basic exploration. And I think there's some really interesting stories, just like Tessa uses in her classes, that you can have the students use data to try to figure out what those stories are from the data. I'm also excited for us to get all of these up on a website that people can get to. We want to build a little dashboard that maybe has some maps on it that give you some of the key insights of what's going on, and also let you sort of generate your own story for the data and find people, right? Just type in a name, things like that. I think that would be huge. One of my things that is this another hard problem, but it's a problem that I'm hoping to help get some students that are interested to help me do is we'll take those familial relationships on those plantations and build out a tree, a family tree, if you will, so that contextually when you're on an individual, you can see that individual's family tree. And that graphically, that while it's structurally relatively simple to do that, graphically, it might be a little challenging. But I would love to see things like that added. And I always enjoy getting students involved in this project for those reasons. It's a great learning opportunity.
Yeah, like Michael, I'm really excited about the prospect of continuing to use this for teaching. I found it to be really useful in terms of helping my students grapple with the realities of slavery as a lived experience and asking them, okay, and looking at this data, what can you deduce about the lives of the people whose names you're seeing here? And I think that for many of our students, slavery can sometimes remain an abstraction. Like they've learned about it since they were very young, but being able to kind of give voice and give a name to people who are enslaved is not necessarily something that they've been able to do. And so I hope that it will be a valuable teaching tool and be useful to researchers who may want to put this this information in comparative perspective. As far as members of descendant communities, I am really looking forward to getting this website up and to making this information freely available, because the images that are on ancestry.com are available through subscription. And so they're not available without paying for it, of course. And also there's a language barrier. Potentially the descendants of the people in the St. Lucia registry are almost certainly English speaking rather than French speaking now. So I'm looking forward to making this information available, but I'm also very conscious that this is a very painful history. And so descendants may or may not want to find their ancestors here, because it's one thing to maybe know that your ancestors were enslaved, but it's another thing to know that your enslaved ancestor was forced to bear the child of a white man when she was 15. Which is something that the registry makes perfectly clear by the fact that the color of the person indicates white parentage, for example, right? Or to know that your ancestor was missing a limb, whether that was a result of an accident when processing sugarcane or whether somebody amputated that limb as a punishment, right? So you really see the brutality of slavery in these documents. And I'm very aware that people might prefer not to see that. And I think that what we can hope to do is make this information as accessible and as interactive as possible, and then allow individuals to decide whether and how they want to interact with that information.
I commend the two of you for coming together to work on this project, Slavery in the Age of Abolition. It's a tremendous collaboration between the iSchool and Maxwell. And the last question for both of you I have before we wrap up on the podcast is, I don't know how unique this type of collaboration is in university settings, but how fortunate do you both feel that at Syracuse you were given opportunities to, you know, pursue this line of research and turn it into something that can be, again, used for good and used for knowledge? I mean, how fortunate do you feel that you've got that opportunity here at the university?
Yeah, I'm so grateful. If for no other reason that I, every time I work on this, I learn something new. And Tessa brings a perspective that, you know, as a historian, I just don't have the capacity to understand until she explained it to me. I'll be honest with you, because it's not my area of expertise. And that's actually what I like about being interdisciplinary is experiencing and learning what other people do and finding a way that I can connect what I do to what they do.
Yeah, it's been an enormously gratifying experience. And Michael and I, when we have meetings, I think we both come away from them just like really amazed at what the other person brings to the table, because I'll say, man, I wish we could know like how many women were enslaved on coffee plantations. And Michael says, oh, I could run a program for that. And 2 hours later, he sends me an email that says, yeah, here's how you could do that. And it's just not something that, unfortunately, I am able to do. And so it's been so fruitful to bring those two areas of expertise together. And we're really hoping that again, this is just the beginning. I think down the line, we'd love to be able to offer probably a graduate class where we get people from the iSchool and people from Maxwell, and particularly the history department, get history graduate students some background in data-driven projects and in that kind of analysis, and vice versa, give iSchool students insights into the kinds of humanities-driven projects that they could be involved in. I know the first grad student that Michael had working on this, Ian, who he mentioned earlier, he went off and worked for like Deloitte or something. I mean, he went off into a lucrative but totally unrelated field. And he said that this was the most rewarding experience that he had as a graduate student, really thinking about how to apply his knowledge, what he had learned at the iSchool, to these very human situations. And so we're really grateful that we were put in touch, and we're hoping to be able to continue this collaboration for a long time to come.
I cannot wait to see what comes next and where the research materializes from here. I want to thank both of our guests on the CUSE Conversations podcast today. We were discussing Slavery in the Age of Abolition, a fascinating, heart-wrenching, but impactful project being done by both Tessa Murphy in the Maxwell School and Michael Fudge in the iSchool. Michael, I appreciate you coming on and discussing how you humanized the data sets and turned them into something that can have a really profound impact. Thank you for sharing your expertise today.
Thank you.
And Tessa, we wouldn't be here without your research and your expertise as well. It's really powerful what you are doing to bring to light a topic that I think oftentimes gets forgotten or swept under the rug. We focus on where we are today, not where we've been in the past, but you're not letting us forget that. And that's very important. And I thank you for sharing your areas of expertise here on the podcast as well.
Thank you so much for having us on. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for checking out the latest installment of the CUSE Conversations podcast. My name is John Boccacino, signing off for the CUSE Conversations podcast.